Our first 10-minute speaker is Nick.
Nicholas Alcoholic. I'm really grateful to be here. It feels really good to be able to contribute. I think that one of the most valuable things I have today is my experience. My sobriety date's November 13, 2012. Atlanta Group's my home group. My sponsor's the infamous Abe, and I worked 12 steps to the best of my ability. My parents were Russian immigrants. I suppose somehow, in theory, that kind of makes me Russian. But I really didn't get anything out the deal except for vodka. My father was an alcoholic. You know, when he drank, when he started, he couldn't stop. And more or less, that's the same thing that happens to me. Something usually has to stop me. I don't spend too much time wondering if this thing is hereditary or not. I don't know if I developed it later on in life or I was born with it. You know, all I know is that I'm here right now. I have an older sister who I admire a lot. You know, who I actually made an amends to today. You know, she has a couple glasses of wine and says, "I'm starting to feel it." You know, and in my mind, that clearly means it's time to get another bottle. But, you know, not to her. You know, not to normal people. In August 1990, my father passed away. My older sister, who I just told you about, she moved to a different continent, and I was raised by a single mother. So I drank. You know, I drank because it was there. I drank because other people did it, and I drank because it helped. You know, if those things hadn't have happened, if those events hadn't have taken place, you know, I'd probably be telling you guys a different story. But I still think that I'd be somewhere telling somebody a story, you know, because even though the consequences in my life weren't a direct result always of alcohol, you know, what they were a direct result of, what I can see now is that they were a result of my thinking and my behavior, which is alcoholic. You know, I can see that today. I could also see how my life was run on fear and resentment and a lot of anger. So, you know, more or less, in a nutshell, you know, my life's been failed attempts at education, job after lost job, a bunch of dysfunctional relationships, and, you know, legal issue after legal issue. A little over a year ago, you know, I reached, I call it a physical limitation. I couldn't drink the way that I wanted to drink. My limitation was I didn't have a job. That job was gone. The lease on the apartment ran out, and I wasn't paying the rent anyway. You know, more or less. And, you know, the support was gone. And November's a cold month, you know. So that equaled, you know, homelessness / detox. So I was in this detox, you know, I'm in this detox, tired, yet proud. And you guys came and, you know, you brought your little AA meetings. And I did you guys a big favor by going to your AA meetings, because I was gonna keep it green for you. You know, I was gonna let you guys know how it was out there. You know. And so I'm sitting in these AA meetings, and you guys are talking about gratitude and humility and you know, and God and all this stuff, and you know, I didn't want none of that. You know, I wanted to stop drinking, and I wanted to get my things back. You know, and but that seed was planted into my brain. And when I left the detox, you know, I went to a meeting, and that's how I was introduced to my sponsor, and that's how I was introduced to the Atlantic Group. And my sponsor gave me a few suggestions. He told me to call him by 12, which I didn't do to the best of my ability. He told me to call the alcoholics, which I thought was stupid. And he told me to stay away from women, which really made me think he wanted me to become gay. You know, So needless to say, you know, I took things into my own hands. And I thought that if I stopped drinking, that my life would get better. And, you know, I stopped drinking and my life got worse. And, you know, I started to suffer. And I started to suffer and it got to a point where it was painful. And it wasn't the same kind of pain that I was used to. This time it was different, you know. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for that moment because that was the moment that I surrendered. You know, and I came up to my sponsor and, you know, I told him that, you know, it wasn't working and that I needed his help. And he said it was about time, you know. And, you know, that was the moment that my recovery started. You know, taking that first suggestion connected me with something that is much bigger than me. A simple act of blind faith, something I really don't fully understand. You know, I don't know what I'm doing up here tonight. I don't know why the Atlantic Group, why this suit, and why so many people, right? But all I know is that I believe in something that's bigger than me, you know? And I have faith in this program. And it's not that I can't say no, it's just that I'm supposed to say yes, you know? So, you know, if you're sitting here and you're pissed off and you don't like AG, I could relate to that. If you think you could do this yourself, I know, you know. If you're sitting here, you don't want to be, but like deep down inside, I really wanted to be part of this, you know. And I can't tell nobody what to do, you know. All I know is that, you know, I don't need to feel the way I felt. I don't have to struggle like that no more, and I know nobody in here does. So I'm not good with the slogans or the stuff that rhymes and, you know, these cliches and all that. You know, but some of the stuff that I do, you know, I go to meetings, I do service, I reach my hand out to other alcoholics. I pray, and I try to the best of my ability to apply these principles into my life. You know, I'm going to say this and pretty much, you know, I'm going to close. I'm not proud of myself for making it this far. You know, my sponsor's not proud of me. He's not proud of himself. You know, we're just grateful that this program exists. If, you know, if you're new, stick around. I want to say that I'm grateful and thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Paige.
Hi, everyone. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Paige.
Hi, Paige.
And my sobriety date is January 8th, 2009. I am a member of the Atlantic Group, and my sponsor is Ava. It's truly a blessing and an honor to be able to do service at my home group. And I want to say that I really am only here because I had the blessing of encountering Bonnie at a meeting down in Boca about 5 years ago. 5 years ago, and I told her that I was moving, or I had just moved from New York. I was getting sober, and she said, if you ever go back to New York, you have to come to the Atlantic Group. You'll love it. It feels like home. You have to check it out. So I had her number in my cell phone for 4 or 5 years, and when I finally came back to New York, this is where I came. Before I moved back to New York from Florida, where I went to get sober, there's a lot of New Yorkers in South Florida, a lot. So I asked some of them, you know, what are some other women you can direct me to when I move back to New York? And that's how I was introduced to my sponsor, Ava. So the pieces kind of fit together, and I'm just really blessed to be here. And honestly, I was very nervous. I still am. But walking into the room tonight, and, you know, encountering all the greeters and all the people who help put this meeting together and make it what it is, I feel just blessed and overwhelmed with joy. And I'm so happy to be here and see the faces of people that have become my really good friends. So how did I get here? basically, I drank too much. I drank for all the right reasons, I drank for all the wrong reasons, and I drank for no reason at all. I always had an abnormal reaction to alcohol. I heard a speaker here, I think it was sometime in the past few months, say that many of us, you know, discover our first drink and our first drunk when we're around like 12 years old, and that's true for me. My family used to vacation every winter to an island where the drinking age is 18, but they didn't really care. And so I was hanging out down there at 12 years old with some people. They were probably older, and you know, and they were drinking, and they said, "Do you want a drink?" And I said, "Okay, I'll have whatever you're having." I didn't know what to ask for. And I remember it was a rum and coke, and I was always, throughout all my childhood, into my teens, I was always, you know, I was very self-conscious. I'm an only child. That doesn't make me an alcoholic, but sometimes I think it does. I was very self-conscious, and I always felt like I couldn't really relate. I didn't know how to be natural and relate to people around me my own age. My parents are older, so there was that age gap. I knew how to, like, you know, I knew how to be polite and how to be a good daughter, but I didn't know how to, like, roughhouse and joke around with people my own age. And so when I was with this group of friends and they said, "Do you want a drink?" I said, "Yes." When I took that drink, it was like the edge literally came right off. I felt like I was a part of this group of people. I felt like I could, you know, talk and not be judged, and that I was, you know, cooler and smarter and all the things that we love about drinking. So I must have been in the sixth or seventh grade. We come back home. I grew up in Rhode Island. And I remember I didn't feel like I could really be open and tell all my, you know, friends, like, this new revelation I had, because I would be judged. How many 12-year-olds are really, you know, are really doing that, are really excited about alcohol? But I was. I was excited about alcohol. So I told a couple people, and they were like, "Okay, like, yeah, like, if we go someplace and there's alcohol, I'll drink with you." But it wasn't really prevalent, and, you know, to be honest, it wasn't my time to become, you know, for my addiction to really take full flight. So I knew alcohol was there. I knew it was fantastic. I knew what it did for me was, you know, basically like a religious experience, but I had other things going on. I was living under my parents' roof. My addictions throughout my teens really turned into schoolwork, eating issues, you know, getting into a good college, dance, tennis, you name it. I didn't have time really for other things, but I knew it was there. So the seed was planted. So after high school, I went off to college. I got into, you know, my choice school. Everything was going really great if you look from the outside in, but I was not happy. And if I look back at pictures of myself, graduation, like, I was not genuinely smiling in any picture I had. I didn't really know what it felt like to be filled up from the inside out. I just didn't know. So when I went to college, the first year, fine. I did great, made some friends. And I came back home, and that's when, and this is where drugs enter my story, that's when I tried drugs for the first time, and I found that that feeling that they did for me was very similar to that feeling alcohol did for me, and for some reason, that's just what was happening back when I tried them, so that's what I continued to do. That basically took me through the next maybe 3 years of college. And meanwhile, I'm drinking all the time. Drinking never really ceased to be in the picture. But like I've heard other people say, the drugs and the drinking took me down really quickly. So after, you know, 3 years in school, I went from being on the dean's list to having to withdraw from all my courses and failing out of one of them. The school asked me to leave and to get help. I didn't know what I needed help for. At that point, I was living in a very big delusion where I was basically, my life was a product of self-will. So I thought that I could take their direction and, you know, go back home to Providence over winter break, do a 2-week outpatient program, and then petition my way back into school. I thought I'd be back for the next semester. But I never stopped drinking. What I did when I moved back to Providence to take this time off is, I thought drugs were my problem, so I said, I'm going to stop doing them. And I'm going to sign up for classes at community college, and I'm going to commit to doing therapy, and yada, 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 and get a dog, of course. And I did all those things. And what happened by the end of that year was that I drank more than I have ever drank, I could ever imagine myself drinking in my whole life. I spent a lot of that year at my parents' house where I grew up. They weren't always home. It was hard for them to be around me. To see me literally killing myself, I think that's a heartbreak for parents to be in that position of helplessness. But what I did at home was we had this whole big bar filled with liquor, aged liquor, like good stuff, the stuff that my parents bring out on holidays, but bottles were never actually emptied. They were always like, they were always full. Finished all of it. It got to the point where literally I was, the consequences of my actions this year were piling up faster than I could lower my standards. And by the end of the year, I was mortified. There was a morning when I was, you know, I woke up in the bedroom that I grew up in, and, you know, it was 11-something a.m., and I always had alcohol with me. I always had it, you know, in the shower with me or next to the bed, and, you know, I just want to say when I started drinking, like, in college and whatnot, at first I was drinking really pretty drinks, like, you know, pink with, like, champagne floaters in nice martini glasses, and at this point it's just whatever. Out of the bottle, anything. So I wake up that morning, it's around December 2008, and I look at the clock, it says 11-something a.m., and I reach down, and this is not unlike any other morning, let me add. This is like a typical morning at this point. I reach down and I pick up the bottle of alcohol, and I don't know if I filled up a shot glass or if I was just about to take, you know, take a sip of it, but I looked at the clock, and all of a sudden I had this feeling. Today I recognize this feeling was God, because it was a feeling I had not had ever in my life, but it was a feeling of helplessness, a feeling that I knew I was helpless and I was ready to accept that. I was ready to give up my will, and I knew that the only way I could emerge from this pit I was in was to ask for help. I didn't know what I needed. I just knew I had to ask for help. So, you know, it's 11-something a.m. I'm about to take a swig out of the bottle, and that's when I believe I did my first step. From then, what I did is I asked for help. I wound up in Florida, where I got sober. I went to rehab, like many people here. I've actually had the privilege of sponsoring two women who are now my close friends and part of this home group. And the first year of my sobriety, I did not take all the suggestions, and I felt a lot of pain. But ultimately, I realized the only way to do this is to take the suggestions of a sponsor. It is to go to meetings. No matter what, it's to put this program and my sobriety first, always. The first thing I did when I visited New York after moving to Florida, with all my luggage, I got off the plane, I went to the intergroup office when I had a year and a half sober, and I got a meeting list because I didn't want to be here without a meeting list. First thing I did when I moved here for good in January was to come to the Atlanta group and find a sponsor. I'm so grateful that this is my home group. I'm so grateful to be here today. Thank you so much for listening, and thanks.
And our main speaker tonight is Jim.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jim. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 20th, 1994. My home group is the Surfside Serenity Group. We meet right on the beach. It's in Bali, Indonesia. And this is a little different from my home group. God, I feel like let's all rise for how it works. We meet right on the beach. It's a little pavilion on the beach, white sand beach, a lagoon with waves breaking out on the outer reef, and we go for a swim afterwards, hang out, go for a surf, and it's safe to say we don't require the speaker to wear a suit. I'd like to thank my sister Jen and Stephanie for asking me to speak. I'd like to thank Duncan for lending me a suit. I'd like to thank Howard for tying my tie. I don't know if I could have said that in early sobriety. I don't know how to tie a tie, but I can say it today. Newcomers keep coming back one day. You know, anyway, Yeah, we just flew in. We arrived Sunday morning at 6 o'clock. I went like 32 hours with no sleep. I can't sleep sitting up. I used to be able to back when I was taking sleeping pills and whatnot. But and then I was sick last night. I almost couldn't make it. I almost couldn't make it, and I'm like delirious from jet lag, but here I am. And I am speaking at the Atlantic Group in front of a big crowd, and now it's like reality. I am here. Wow. Anyway, I come from Miami, Florida. I've been living in Bali for like 25 years. But I was born and raised in Miami, Florida. There's four kids in my family. Three of them are in AA. My little sister, Jen. My older sister, Julie, has like 30 years. And me. And, I like to say my sister, my older sister, got the brains of the family. And my little sister got the good looks. And I got the humility and the spirituality. But, you know, this strange thing happened back in Florida, you know, years ago. We were all speaking at my sister's home group. And we were like consecutive weeks we were all speaker. We all happened to be in town at the same time. And all three of us went up and shared what our childhood was like. And then if you would have listened to it, you go, did these guys come from the same house? It sounded like we were from a completely different culture. You know, it's just my perception of how our grew up. So, and our parents didn't drink. So three kids are in AA. My little brother's not an alcoholic. My parents didn't drink, so I can't blame my parents, you know, for that. Shucks. God, I thought I'd get off on that one. You know, the book says self is self-centered. That's the root of my problems. It doesn't say my parents are the root of my problems. Anyway, first time I got loaded, I was 13 years old. How do you describe this? You know, it's like, I don't know if anybody remembers, but back in, anybody remembers? Today they have like digital music, right? You download it. And before that you had CDs. And then before that you had cassettes. Now we're going way back. Now, before that you had 8-track tapes. And before that you had music pressed onto this round plastic thing called a vinyl album. Vince, you remember that, right? Me and Vince remember, right? Anyway, so... And so, but back, you would get this album and it would rotate at 33 RPMs, revolution. And then there was this album, Jimi Hendrix, Third Stone from the Sun. Some of you remember? Okay. So anyway, if you sped up that album on the song, Third Stone from the Sun, if you sped it up to 45, you heard this secret message. You heard like this communication between the extraterrestrials. That's what drinking the first time did for me. I now had the secret. The secret message. I was like a normal kid in school. I did well. I was like popular with sports. I had girls and this and that. And I was like level. And then that first time I got loaded, like I like rose above. And I could see the world. I heard music. I knew what the hippies were singing about. You know, down went the football posters. Up went the Pink Floyd posters and the black lights. Remember those? And so I stopped hanging out with the sporty guys and started hanging out with the losers. And my parents took, at seventh grade, my parents took me out of the public school system because I was getting deeply involved with all these losers, and they put me into a private school up in Lauderdale. And now I'm with all these rich kid losers that had money to buy stuff. Anyway, so one day this kid shows up. He had gotten transferred from somewhere else. And he's sitting there at lunch, and he was so wasted at lunch. And I'm sitting next to him, and he's like eating his cheeseburger, and the cheese is like dripping out onto his chin. And I go, hey, man, what's up? He goes, I smoked 2 joints, took 3 Placidals, drank 4 Colt 45 Tall Boys, and I'm so wasted. And I said to myself, that guy's cool, man. And he became my best friend. But anyway, so I don't want to really get into my drunkologue, but to cut a long story short, I started surfing at about the age of 16, and I started chasing waves around the world. And, you know, and it's important for me to tell you, there's just like, my father was a doctor, well-respected member of the community, and the course was laid out for me to go to college, you know, like that. And about the age of 16 or so, I started... marketing and distribution of horticultural products. that were not approved by the FDA. So I started to, you know, have some money, and then it was this choice, go to college or take this money and go travel around the world surfing and chasing beautiful women and chasing the best waves in the world. What do you think I did? I started, you know, cruising around the world, and but I always did just enough legal things to keep them at bay, keep my parents happy, keep the courts, where did I get my money? You know, I went to junior college, I did things, I had jobs and stuff like that, but there was always that, I knew what I was. You know, I knew I was a fraud. I knew I was, wasn't real. I wasn't this person I had made out myself to be. And as my alcoholism progressed, so I ended up living in Bali. I first went in 1983. About the 89, 90, I ended up just pretty much staying there. So at this time, you know, I'm my disease is progressing, and I've always told myself, if I ever got real bad, I'll quit. If I ever started to cross lines, I'll quit. And if I ever start to do things I said I would never do, I'll quit. And I started to cross those lines one by one by one, and then things got really bad and trouble with the law. I knew things were going down, and I couldn't stay away. I had to keep going. I couldn't stop. And I started to get really scared. And it was always in the back of my mind that if I really need to quit, I'll quit. I'll be able to do it. You know, I'll call out the troops, full court press. I'll get it together, and I'll quit. And I went into this as my disease progressed, I stuck with that. I kept trying to quit. I kept trying to control it. I kept trying to stop as things got worse. And I would do crazy stuff to try and quit. I would, like, you know, get my stuff, you know, and I'd mark on it Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you know, and then by, you know, Wednesday, it's gone. You know, by Tuesday, it's gone. You know, I would hide it from myself. I would do crazy things. My friend would hide his at my house, and I'd hide mine at his house. We say, we're not going to get on until 12 o'clock, you know, and then like 10 o'clock in the morning, we pass each other on the road. He's heading to my house. I'm heading to his house. You know, crazy stuff like that. And so my solution was to, I had to get away. I had to just get out of Parkuta, like Seminyak, this party town in Bali. It was just, you know, crazy 24-hour-a-day party town. And my solution, I had to get away. Just get away. And so I would drive like an hour and a half up into the mountains, up into Ubud, this really quiet artist community way up in the mountains. And I would drive up there, and I'm quitting. That's it. I got to quit. This is it. Things are bad. I'm quitting for good. And I would check myself in this little hut in the rice fields, and I know I'm not coming out for 3 or 4 days. I know the drill now, the detox drill. And I'd, you know, get a couple bottles of water, a couple bananas, some packaged bread, some sleeping aids, and stuff like that. And then I'd go start going through withdrawals and detox. And I'd sit there for 3 days, and I'd shake, and I'd sweat. And I remember this one time, it was, you know, it's like 90-100 degrees out in the middle of this rice field, and the electric went out, so the fan went off. And then they're burning something outside, and then there's these roosters and chickens crowing outside, and I'm like, I go, this is hell. I can't do this anymore. This is hell. And you kind of lose control a little bit down there, and I went to Pass Wind. I'm being polite here at the Atlantic Group. I went to Pass Wind, and I miscalculated it. And I laid there for a couple hours because I was too sick and too miserable to get up. And I finally did. This is what I was going through. And I finally, after 3-4 days, I'd start to feel better. And I'd go out in the ports, and I'd do jumping jacks, and I'd stretch. And then I'd stop at Casa Luna, and I'd have wheatgrass juice, carrot juice, oatmeal, blueberry, yogurt, granola, and just power myself full of vitamins. And it's a sunny day, and I feel good. I go, oh, this is great. Now I got everything out of my system. And I start driving back to town. And I'm saying, you know what? I'm moving out of Kuta. I'm going back to Nusa Dua. My other buddies, they're doing, you know, they're surfing every day, spearfishing, and, you know, they're doing all healthy stuff. They're not going to the party town, all that. And I'm going to go home. I'm going to grab my board. I'm going to head over to Nusa Dua. I'm not going back there again. That's it. I know what's going to happen if I go back again. I'm not going to do it. And so I'm driving back. It's a beautiful day. I'm, like, figuring out which board I'm going to ride, you know, and it's probably 4 feet, 5 feet, New Sudan. I'm going to go over there, grab my board, and I get to a three-way intersection, and I can go right to Party Town or left over to the New Sudua, and I get light turns green, and then, boom, the car just turns itself, by itself. And I start heading back to the bars, to the dealers, to the Party Town. And I'm watching myself. Now, this, what I just told you about, between 1992 and 1994, I did this 20, 30, 40 times. I lost track. I'm going to quit for good, get there, boom. Sometimes I went a couple days, but eventually, boom, it just turns itself, and I'm going there. And I can't turn the car around. I do not have, once that thought enters my mind, I'm going, I can't turn the car around. Step one, I'm powerless over alcoholism. My life has become unmanageable. I do not have the, from the tip of my toe to my balding head, I do not have the power to turn the car around. You could have stopped and lined up a Thai massage parlor. Five beautiful Thai girls are going to give you a naked massage. Or here's, you know, you pull in here and you're going to get the job of your life. Or pull over here, you're going to get something incredible. But if you stop, you're going to miss it. You're not going to be able to go. I'm just driving by, right by every single one of those. Because it's an obsession, a thought that overrides all other thoughts. I cannot turn the car around. Step two, came to believe in a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. By going and doing that again and again, it's insanity. Okay? So the car turns itself. Now I'm going back again. At this stage of my mind, I know what's going to happen. Let's take a snapshot and show it to me. The line in the book, why does he walk directly back into the saloon? Of what is he thinking? Okay, everybody here has done that because you're here. Okay, Asha, what were you thinking? What other than the precise definition of the word insanity is this? It's insanity for me to do that again, caused by my powerlessness that I'm going to do this again. Okay, and so over and over and over, I've been doing this. Now, okay, so that's what it was like. What happened? So similar to kind of what Paige was talking about earlier, I'm getting loaded by myself. Usually there was this route I had. You know, I'd go to the early bar, and then I'd go to the next bar, have dinner, and then I'd come back home, and I, you know, I'm a chameleon, so the Aussie bars, I'm wearing a tank top, you know, this and that. Then I come home, now I'm going to with the classy European scumbags. I'm like, so I come back and I change my clothes and I get busy at home, you know, with the real deal. And I'm doing my deal, and usually I would, you know, knock back 8 or 10 and then continue on to the bar. I'm on my third one and I pass out. I fainted. I OD'd. As I went down, I hit my head on the corner of the desk. I hit my eye. And I hit my shoulder, and I'm down out. I'm out on the floor. This is in August of 1994. I'm out cold of my little bungalow in Kuta, alone. It's like 1 o'clock in the morning. And I can't tell you if I was out for 5 minutes, 3 minutes, an hour. I don't know. But I came to, and I went like that, and I saw blood on my hand, and I looked at my shoulder and go, oh, man, what the hell happened? And I got up to go wash myself. And I washed myself off, and I looked in the mirror, and I saw me looking back at me. I saw this lifeless, soulless skeleton of a human being. This disease had sucked the soul out of me, sucked anything worthwhile in life out of me. I was just existing to keep going, and that was it. And I couldn't look at that picture anymore. Now I'm obsessed, and I'm going, why did this happen? What? And I went and checked it all out. This looks normal. I usually do 8 or 10. I've done like 3, and now I'm like, what do I do next? Now I'm obsessed. Why did this happen? And I came up with an idea. I'm going to do another one. We'll see what happens. Now, I told you, I went to college. I'm no dummy. I set up pillows this time in case I fell again. So I set up the pillows. I did the one more, and I sat down. What's going to happen? Is my head going to explode? Am I going to go back to normal? What's going to happen? And that's when it happened. I had a moment of clarity. I saw at that precise moment the exact truth of my alcoholism. I saw not only where I was at that moment, no more rationalization, no more justification, no more denial, no more it's not that bad, no more you'll be able to quit, no more when it gets real bad you're quitting. I saw the truth. And I saw not only the truth of that moment, I was given like this fast-forward preview of what was about to happen. That I was going to die, I was going to end up in jail, something so horrible was about to happen. You know, like when you're dreaming and you're falling and you scream? I scream. That was real. And from somewhere inside here, not an intellectual, these words came out of my mouth. I looked up and I went, God, if you're out there, please help me, I'm fucked. Pardon my language, but that's the way the prayer went at the time. And God didn't seem to mind, because the next thought that came into my head was, why don't you call up your older sister in AA? Call up Julie. And so I went, I can't sugarcoat my bottom. If I start to sugarcoat my bottom, I'm sorry. I apologize. Anyway. So why don't you call up your sister Julie? So I walked over to the hotel next door that had an international phone. This is before email, before, you know, cell phones and all that. And I walked up and I called Julie, and I got her on the phone. Julie, I need help. I can't stop. I'm scared. Please take me to one of those meetings. All I knew about AA, that it worked for my sister. I saw her in the grips of this thing. I saw her get sober. And then we didn't have all that much contact after that, because I was living in Bali. She was, you know, living in Miami. Anyway, so about 4 days later, I got on the airplane home to get help. And that airplane ride, this is the only way I know my sobriety date, was August 20th, 1994. I had the ticket stub. So I flew home, and she took me to my first meeting. And it was a trip, my first meeting. I remember we had showed up. I'd come with my sister, Jen, my older sister, and another girl, Sherry. And we got there late. If you know my sisters. Sorry, Jen. It was Julie's fault. Anyway, so we got there late, so I didn't introduce myself as a newcomer. And I just said, I don't know what they're talking about. I knew the guy that was doing the big book study. I couldn't put it all together. Anyway, at the end of the meeting, they tell me to go up and get they start doing something about chips. Oh, you guys gamble. That's what you do. Oh, yeah. That's how you get over it, you know. And then you're all gathered around a coffee pot. Oh, you drink coffee instead of that's what you do. I thought you were going to give me a top 10 list of things, how to stop drinking, how to not drink. Anyway, so they all poke me. You got to go up and get it. Okay. And I get up, and I stood up in the whole room. They start cheering like the Dolphins just recovered a fumble at a Jets football game. And they're going crazy. And they're like, wow, it's for me. Huh? Pretty cool. And so I get to the front of the room. And I took the chip, and they're all screaming, and I turned around, and I looked out the crowd, and they're all looking at me like a Lassie movie, you know, like, no. And I remember everything going silent. There was, you know, their chip, but I just went silent. And I didn't know what was going on. It took me like 2 years to figure out. There was the first time in my life I had experienced unconditional love. Everybody in that room had done that walk. Everybody in the room knew what a big deal it was when an alcoholic comes in here and picks up a white chip for the first time. I hope we never forget that, what a big deal it is. And they had all done that. And I remember after the meeting, some guy comes up to me and goes, how you doing? I go, well, not too good. And he said, I can see the pain in your eyes. And at that moment, I knew. He knew how I felt because he had been there, but at that moment I knew he was somewhere else, in some place I had never experienced. Anyway, so it took me a while to get into the steps because I didn't need them. I had, you know, it was obviously, I heard you guys sharing at meetings, you had problems other than drinking. You had, you know, relationship issues and stuff like that. It was pretty obvious. And so I didn't need the steps, but eventually I got into them. And so here I am. I can't believe it. I'm like 19 and a half years sober. My life, through these steps, the steps have changed me through God. You know, the steps were the third step, and the second step came to believe in a power greater than ourselves. It doesn't say come to believe in God. Come to believe in some power when that car turns its back to the bar again is going to put me back on the road. That was my first experience with the second step. And it comes from deep down. It talks about we agnostic, deep down within us. You know when you're on an airplane and you start to hit turbulent weather, and then you hit very turbulent, and then the plane drops like what you hear, everyone go, "Oh God." That's in us. That's deep down within us. It's brought out by impending calamity and a realization of one's own powerlessness. And it becomes a cry out for help for something other than human. I just quoted the William James Varieties of Religious Experience, which was Bill, and that's what happened to me. And the third step doesn't, you know, it's learning how to trust God. And the fourth step for me was putting a mirror of the truth in front of me, you know, that I don't want to see the truth. You know, and the fifth step is just becoming another human being, becoming an alcoholic. Sixth and seventh step I had a hard time with. I mean, I knew it, but I had, at about 6 or 7 years, I went through the, I don't know if anybody else, did the pornography thing, you know, sex. I'm looking at this crowd here, you've probably never been through something like this, sexual problems. You all look so spiritually fit. But it was dry, it was like turning back all over again. It was just a repeat performance of the same exact behavior. I'm not going to do this today, and I go do it again. But now I've got, you know, I'm 6 or 7 years. I'm like a big book thumper. I got it, you know, I'm sponsoring guys. I'm doing this. I'm doing workshops. I'm bringing meetings into the prisons. I started bringing into the meetings to the prisons in Indonesia, some of the first meetings in there. And I'm doing that. So I'm praying for God to please remove from me this obsession. And there's like nobody home. Then I go into prisons, and I get down on my knees in the scummiest toilet you can imagine. I ask God to speak through me to help carry the message, and I just feel this vibe coming through me. So I know God's there for that. And so it came down to it like this. I had to look at the truth was that what if God would have showed up in my 6th and 7th step prayer and goes, "I'm going to take it away completely. You're never, ever, ever going to say your thing is smoke. You're never going to have one cigarette again. You're never going to have a chocolate fudge triple Haagen-Dazs sundae again. You're never going to look at another porn site, get another massage, ever, ever again." And I'm going, "Whoa, hold on, God, give me a minute here." Yeah. I had to look at that I was full of it, okay? That I wasn't fully, entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. I want to talk a little about service before. How much time do I got? 6 minutes. I want to talk about service. We translated the big book into Indonesian, and the rehab started up there, and we got some meetings going. I can speak fluent Indonesian, so I started. We were bringing meetings into the prisons there, and so many things have happened for the past 14 or 15 years. Either a Tuesday or Wednesday, I've had an H&I commitment. I bring a meeting into the prison or the rehab. The Indonesian rehab kind of fell apart, and now this Australian rehab. And so I've been doing it for the past 14 years. Every Tuesday, I take guys through the big book, and it's like a guided big book study. It's fantastic. I see eyes. I see lights come on. I see eyes open up. But I also see, you know, we've taken, between me and my sponsor, probably 400 people through the book. We counted the other day, we've had 15 people die. They committed suicide, or they overdosed, or they, you know, wrecked cars or whatever. We've had people, a lot of people don't make it. And just recently, a guy I was getting kind of close to, Terry, was like my star pupil, my star sponsee. He went out. They put him in a taxi cab, and his eyes exploded in his head, and by the time he got to the hospital, he was dead. And just last week, I'm doing the big book study, and I have his big book, all the stuff he underlined. You know, and there's a line in there that it causes man to make the extreme sacrifice rather than fight. And I explained that it was suicide. And he underlined it, suicide. And just the other day, about a couple weeks ago, Doc, this Australian football player, another guy, totally into it, come up after, "Jim, that was great. I never heard it put like it was unbelievable. That was great. I can't wait to do more. Let's go, let's go, let's go." Something, relationship, one, whatever, hooked the hose up to his car. They found him dead. This program works. The power works. God works. The connection. The connection is the deal. The relationship. Establishing the relationship with God. Which I could not do till I got to that point of... They talk about... This snuffed out the last flicker of hope that I could do the job myself. The general consensus among physicians is most alcoholics are doomed. If something doesn't happen, I'm going to die. I'm done. I'm finished. You know, I don't like to sugarcoat the first step. You know, I tell these guys, you know, I'm tired of losing people. I'm tired of it. You know, I could do the best job I could going through that book, explaining the steps and where it comes from my experience. But if the transmitter can transmit it, if the receiver is not tuned in, the message doesn't get carried. Okay? And it was up to me to turn on that transmitter, to somehow realize my transmitter, my receiver, today, I got to have my receiver on. There's no graduation date here. You know, there was a line I was looking for in Pass It On, which I love it. When Bill Wilson went through all his depression, they suggested, afterwards they suggested to Bill Wilson, hey, Bill, you ever think of working the steps again? Imagine Bill saying, my dear son, do you reason I wrote those steps? You know, you're suggesting to moi to work the steps again? And then Bill said, Above all is my failure to continue to work the steps. To make a constant practice of the 12 steps, to make a persistent effort to get to where the problem stems. To get to if my problem stems from my ego, from self, from selfish self-centeredness. To get constant effort to get that out of the picture so God can flow in. It's as simple as that. It's a constant effort. Clear away the crap so God can come in on a constant effort. And how do I get that? How, if there's anything to get that channel flowing, what for me is the absolute best way to do that? Stick myself in front of a table in front of 6 newcomers that have been forced into this rehab and are not happy to be there whatsoever. They want to talk about the laws and the counselors and this and that. Why are they here? Blah, 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 blah. And you know what? And I start just reading the magic from this book, reading it and sharing my experience. They go from like, I've never heard it put like that. You know, I've been 12 years and I've never, have you ever been to big books? No. Why don't you go to one when you get out of here? Whatever. Anyway, I think I'm about out of time. I'm going to share one quick story and I'm done. So, God's up there. He's real, real busy, and he's got this assistant to help him out, Max. So, he's checking in at the end of the day. Max goes, what's going on down there on Earth? And every day he goes, well, it's a usual thing. People living in New York want to go to Bali. People in Bali want to live in New York. The single guys want to be married, and the married guys want to be single, and they're not happy with that. And they're not, the usual show, yeah, the usual deal again there. Anything else before we close up shop? He goes, well, there's this one lunatic. He lives up on this hill in Bali. For the past 19 years, all he's ever said to us is thank you at the end of the day. And God looks down and he goes, you know what? Let's give that guy anything he wants. Thank you.